But it's time now we return to our definition of art. But first I want to consider a possible objection. Some people, I think, might be a bit shocked by the bold claim that the true artist represents a higher type of humanity than the ordinary decent citizen. Some people might even be tempted to point out, very nicely of course, that only too often the artist, unfortunately, most regrettably, is wicked and immoral and selfish. So it's worth perhaps looking into this a little. One can readily admit that the artist, whether painter or poet or musician, can be rather difficult to live with. But this, I think, is usually due to the fact that very often the artist is concerned, and rightly concerned, to safeguard from intrusion his own privacy and his own conditions of work. We know too that there are well-meaning people who try to make the artist conform, try to make him like other people. They try to make him perhaps live like other people, dress like other people, look like other people, even write like other people, paint like other people, and so on. And it's only natural, perhaps, that the artist tends to rebel against these well-meaning attempts, sometimes even violently. And rather ungratefully, he insists upon being himself. And we also often find that the artist is in revolt against conventional morality. This is especially conspicuous, we may say, in the case of a poet like Shelley, who flouted all the moral canons, at least the conventional moral canons, of his day, and was ostracized for so doing. But one might say, is the artist's flouting of conventional morality wrong? We only too often we have to recognize that it is conventional morality itself which is at fault. And the artist's rejection of it is, in fact, in many cases, if not most cases, simply an expression of his own more healthy and more normal mental attitude. We mustn't also forget, and this is very, very important, we mustn't also forget that the artist, of whatsoever kind, is only too often a deeply divided person. That is to say, divided within himself. And sometimes, the greater the artist, the more deeply divided he is within himself. And this deep division, this cleft, sometimes in the depths of his own being, is productive of tension and of lack of balance, bordering even sometimes on madness. The artist, by very definition perhaps, has access to higher states of consciousness, higher states of being than most other people, or than almost all other people. But this does not mean that he has access to them all the time. To quote Shelley, whom I've just mentioned, Shelley says in one of his poems, or sings in one of his poems, "Rarely, rarely comest thou, spirit of delight." And this is only too often the experience of the artist, the creator, the poet, the musician, that this spirit of delight, this higher experience, this experience of a higher mode of being and consciousness, comes only rarely, only sometimes. The artist does not live in these higher states all the time. And in this, the artist differs from the mystic, from the true mystic, who tends to dwell in these states, if not all the time, most of the time, or at least much of the time. And in the case of the artist, sometimes in these higher states of consciousness and experience, sometimes in more ordinary states, in the case of the artist, it's only too often as though the artist were two people. When he creates, he's one person. When he's not creating, he's another person. And we all know only too well that sometimes you read a book by somebody, you think, what a wonderful book, what a wonderful person the author must be, how I'd like to meet him. And when you go along, full of sort of gratitude and willing to be full of admiration for this wonderful book which has uplifted you so much, you find some dry, withered, mean little man, and you're sorry that you ever set eyes on him. You're so disappointed, And this is because of this sort of cleavage, this sort of split, this sort of division between the sort of the higher experience of the artist and his more ordinary, his more normal experience. It's as though, as though the artist is two people, as though he has an artistic self and an ordinary self. And there's this sort of cleavage, this sort of split, this sort of division between them. And this is why, traditionally, we often speak in terms of inspiration. That the artist's inspiration comes from on high, as it were, comes to him from above. It isn't him. There's this well-known story in this connection of Handel. When he finished the manuscript of Messiah, when he read it over, he was astonished himself that he'd written anything so good. And he was so astonished, we're told, that he just put down his pen, he looked up, and he said, "It came from above. This isn't me." Now he's back in his ordinary state of consciousness. "It isn't me. I didn't produce this. It came from above." It came, that is to say, from the artist himself when he was in this higher, this supranormal state and stage of consciousness. And this is also one of the reasons why traditionally we refer to the artist as a genius. We speak of a poetic genius. We speak of an artistic genius in general, or a musical genius and so on. And what does this word mean? What does genius mean? Genius meant originally one's guardian deity, like one's guardian angel or one's good angel. It represented the sort of higher powers overshadowing a man, guiding him and directing him. Represented, we may say, one's own higher self, conceived of as an independent or quasi-independent personality that was one's source, that is to say, the ordinary self's source of inspiration and direction and guidance. And we get the same sort of idea behind this, or classical conception of the muses. When you read, say, Homer's Iliad or Odyssey, what does he do at the beginning? He invokes the muses. He says, "Goddess," or "Goddess," says, "inspire me." And all the classical poets did this. Milton does it at the beginning of Paradise Lost, except that he invokes the heavenly muse and not the profane muse. But the idea is the same. You're invoking some higher source, some higher power, which seems outside you, but which is at the same time, really and truly, your own higher, your own highest self. And it's from there that the creation comes. Incidentally, it's interesting to notice an observation on the use of the word genius by that well-known modern writer, Nabokov. And he makes this observation in the course, I find, of an interview printed in last week's Listener. I don't know whether anybody has seen this, but it is rather interesting, even though incidental, so I'm going to quote it. He's being interviewed by one of these rather pertinacious people who ask all sorts of questions, and one wonders how people sometimes have the patience to answer the questions. And this particular question is whether Nabokov sees himself as a genius. He's being asked whether he sees himself like this. So what does he say? He says in reply, "The word genius is passed around rather generously, isn't it? At least in English, because its Russian counterpart, genie, is a term brimming with a sort of throaty awe, and is used only in the case of a very small number of writers, Shakespeare, Milton, Pushkin, Tolstoy. To such deeply beloved authors as Turgenev and Chekhov, Russians assign the thinner term, talent, not genius. It is a bizarre example of semantic discrepancy, the same word being more substantial in one language than in another. Although my Russian and my English are practically coeval, I still feel appalled and puzzled at seeing genius applied to any important storyteller, such as Maupassant or Morme. Genius still means to me, in my Russian fastidiousness and pride of phrase, a unique, dazzling gift. The genius of James Joyce, not the talent of Henry James." Now, one might not agree with his estimation of Henry James, but I think the force of the distinction is clear. He's using the word genius very much as I've been using it in the course of these lectures. in the sense of the true artist. In fact, when I read this first, I almost thought that he'd been attending these lectures. Perhaps he has. But there is something else that I'd like to draw your attention to while we're at it. And this is the interviewer's first question. And it's rather extraordinary. I don't know where he got these questions from. But the first question was, what distinguishes us from the animals? And what do you think Nabokov says? I'm going to quote this also, because it has a great bearing on the subject matter of the whole course. What distinguishes us from the animals? Now, this is what Nabokov says. Being aware of being aware of being. So I repeat that. Being aware of being aware of being. In other words, if I not only know that I am, but also know that I know it, then I belong to the human species. All the rest follows. The glory of thought, poetry, a vision of the universe. In that respect, the gap between ape and man is immeasurably greater than the one between amoeba and ape. The difference between an ape's memory and a human memory is the difference between an ampersand and the British Museum Library. So, I think you'll agree that that is very much the sort of thing that we have been saying in the course of these lectures and in previous lectures also on similar topics. But we really must now get back to our definition of art, which has got lost on the way, as it were.